This is Fine Art Insights with Michael Rose. Welcome back to Fine Art Insights. On today's episode, I'm very happy to welcome Peter Mello. Peter is the Managing Director and Co-CEO of Waterfire Providence. Waterfire is one of the nation's most popular public art projects, and since its founding in 1994, has been a transformational influence on the city of Providence and the entire region, really. Peter joined Waterfire in 2011, and prior to joining Waterfire, he served as Executive Director of Tall Ships America. Peter is a lifelong mariner, he's a very prolific photographer, and he's also a hockey player. He earned his BA in economics from Connecticut College and has also pursued professional development at the University of Pennsylvania and at Harvard. When I was a senior in college, I interned for Waterfire. In the year that I graduated from college, I spent about half of that year working as a staff member for Waterfire. And during my time with Waterfire, Peter was my boss, and he was an excellent influence and a great mentor to me as I started a career in the visual arts. If you'd like to learn more about Waterfire, you can go to their website at waterfire.org. And if you'd like to learn more about Peter, you can follow him on Instagram, Twitter, and on Clubhouse at Peter Mello. What follows, I think, is a really interesting conversation about Peter's work and about Waterfire as an arts organization. So hi, Peter. Thank you for being with me today. I appreciate it. It's nice to see you and to hear you.
Thanks for inviting me. And thanks. Sorry, we've had been trying to schedule this for a long time. So
No, I'm very happy to have you. It's exciting. So first, for people who are listening who might not be familiar with Waterfire, would you like to give like a very short overview of what Waterfire Providence is?
Yeah, Waterfire Providence is an arts nonprofit in Providence, Rhode Island. Started about 25 years ago, roughly, by Barnaby Evans, and initially started as an art experience event, art installation downtown Providence on the rivers that run through downtown Providence. We have an art installation that engages large groups of large public art event, put it that way, and we have water and fire. There are about a little less than 100 floating braziers that run through the center on the rivers that go through downtown Providence. And there's music and there's other performance art and all kinds of things that take place. And been doing this 25 years. In a normal year, we probably do it about 20 times a year. And each time is about 50 to 60,000 people come out for each event. And over the course of a year, close to 1 million people. And not only is a transformative event for Providence, it also is a huge economic driver. It generates about $114 million of economic impact for the state of Rhode Island, which generates about $9.5 million of tax revenue for the Treasury and supports 1,294 jobs for local residents. So it's pretty special. And then as a result of a strategic planning process in 2012, we have bought an old historic building and we transformed that into our first public, visible public presence in the community. Before that, it was difficult to find us. And we opened up in 2017, the Waterfire Art Center, after a long fundraising and planning and construction phase. And in the Valley, Olneyville neighborhood of Providence, we have this amazing art center where right now, the last week of a show that is up, Mary Beth Meehan, in a gallery that's roughly about 15,000 square feet. It's pretty impressive space, and has hosted a bunch of different art experiences over the last couple of years.
That's a great overview. Yeah, for people who haven't experienced Waterfire before, Waterfire was really like one of the transformative things for Providence in the 90s. You know, it really made Providence an art location for the first time, as Providence was sort of coming out of the doldrums of the early 90s. Now at Waterfire, Peter, you are the co-CEO. Can you talk a little bit about what that's like? So you're co-CEO, and then Barnaby, who's the originator of Waterfire, the sort of artistic mind behind Waterfire, shares that sort of responsibility with you. Can you talk about that model and what that's like for you?
Yeah, so I joined a decade ago, 10 years ago, it's hard to believe. Right around that time, you were actually an intern here, I think, sometime around then. So we go back that far. And WaterFire is transitioning to the dual leadership model that a lot of arts institutions have. There's an artistic head and a management head. So that took place. So, you know, I handle most of the day-to-day management strategic stuff, and he's still the artistic visionary. He's an incredibly talented artist, and what he does has this incredible impact on the community. But much like, you know, when I first took this job, actually I was doing leadership consulting, and I had an opportunity to go down to Annapolis, U.S. Naval Academy, to lecture a plebe class, first year class about leadership. And the night before, I had dinner with the chair of the leadership department, and I was like, hey, I'm going to this new job, and it's this dual leadership model, and I'm not finding a lot of there's not a lot of books and articles about this thing. And he says, you know, you're right, but, you know, he said, they're kind of like a marriage. Like, you're both responsible for everything, right? When you bring up kids or when you run the household, you're both responsible for everything, but somebody might be better at some things than other things. So, you know, I get involved some of the art things, Barnaby gets us involved with some of the business things. So it's not just these like silos we're operating under. It's a partnership.
Had you worked with other artists prior to coming to WaterFire, or had your work been primarily in another field?
Yeah, so prior to WaterFire, I was a little stint doing some leadership consulting stuff. But prior to that, I ran the Tall Ships organization, which is an international nonprofit that uses these sailing ships for character building and educational purposes for youth. But the most visible thing that they do are these Tall Ships festivals and port festivals. And they race the ships we race the ships between the four festivals. So my first nonprofit job was that job. I was executive director and CEO of that organization. And that's similar to WaterFire. These Tall Ships festivals and events, people go to see them and they don't really know what they're looking at. They just, you know, their imaginations run wild with them, right? And there's the romance of the sea and pirate ships, and they tell their and create their own stories. And much like WaterFire, people come to WaterFire and they come, you know, not really knowing what they're going to experience. And everybody's experience is a little different, but it's been pretty universally hailed as this transformative experience, whether it's an individual experience with the artwork itself at WaterFire or the idea that you're in a group of 50,000 people and you're sharing this experience with this group in a very peaceful way. So it's pretty unique. And both those, I feel both of those kind of things, they're very similar arts and cultural events.
And I imagine that at Tall Ships, there was a lot of like team energy that went into that. And it was a big, I think some of the, probably the production elements of that sort of crossover into what you're doing at WaterFire, because WaterFire is this enormous production. Can you talk a little bit about just what goes into putting together like a single WaterFire and like how many staff and volunteers and stuff are involved in making these events happen?
Yeah, WaterFire is an amazing undertaking. We have a staff of 25 people roughly in good times, 25 full-time staff, 12 months a year. And then we have about 25 people, 20 to 25 people we hire on event days when we do WaterFire downtown. We also have a staff here in the Art Center now that are dedicated to that. But really the big event downtown is the thing that got us the Art Center and is what we're known most popularly for. And that event itself takes an army, literally. We work on any given WaterFire with between 200 to 500 volunteers on any given week for that we have a WaterFire between setting up and actually staging the event and striking the event, breaking it down after. So it's incredible logistics planning. Our director of events and operations, Paul Kahanek, is a master at it. It's a full day affair. We start at about 6 in the morning and we end up about 3 in the morning when all said and done. And when you go the next morning, get your coffee on Sunday morning, there's not a trace of us downtown. You kind of rub your eyes and say, did that really happen last night? It's hard to believe that you can be taken to such a different place in a city and the next morning, not a trace of it.
I think WaterFire is one of these organizations that makes everything look so easy that in a way, although the public is so familiar with WaterFire and Rhode Islanders know WaterFire, that sometimes they may not appreciate just what an undertaking it is, because it appears to just sort of show up out of nowhere. And then, like you said, it sort of disappears out of nowhere. But Through your internship program and all these different things you're doing, you do get out into the community. I, like you said, was an intern for Waterfire and worked a number of events for a season. And it was a remarkable experience, really. And I mean, it really shows you what goes into putting together big productions, whether you're a visual art person or a theater person or something. There were, I'm sure it's still the same way now. When I worked with Waterfire, there were people with all different kinds of backgrounds that all came together, and each sort of skill set added something to what we were all putting together there. So I think that is sort of interesting. Can you talk a little bit about what this last year or 18 months or whatever it's been, has been like for Waterfire in a space where you couldn't host events, and how did that impact the organization, and what changes have happened to you all since then?
Yeah, it's been a crazy year for everybody, right? And we certainly have had a crazy experience, I'll say. You know, what we do is we bring large groups of people together to experience art or experience things, whether it's downtown for the event or whether it's here in the Waterfire Art Center, which is also a very popular venue. So one thing I didn't mention is that it's when we developed the Waterfire Art Center, it diversified our mission, but it also diversified and added revenue streams. It's a very popular place for people to have galas and weddings and things like that, and it generates considerable revenue for us. Both of our revenue streams were eliminated last year during the pandemic. The event downtown, we were hoping to do, we budgeted to do $1.2 million of sponsorship, which is a typical what we would do in a season. We ended up doing $48,000 of sponsorship, and the art center itself, the revenue in this space was down 85% last year. So both of our revenue streams were hammered by the pandemic. We knew we needed to pivot. So we started focusing our activities here on the Waterfire Art Center, something we wanted to do for a number of years, but because we had such a full plate with the event downtown, we haven't been able to do that. So we immediately shifted staff around to really focus on things because we thought that it would recover here quicker in the Art Center. We wanted to keep the team together as long as we could keep that team together. So we hustled, and we found, we were the beneficiary of CARES Act funding in 2020. It was very helpful for us. We worked with the Rhode Island Commerce Corporation to secure funds through Take It Outside grants, through a whole list of CARES Act grants that kept us alive. Without that, we wouldn't be talking today, frankly. We also partnered with the Wilbury Theater, a great theater company that was located down the street here last year. Has since moved in. In January, they moved in. They're resident here in the Waterfire Art Center. And last year, we collaborated on a number of things. So we thought we could never just shut down. We had to keep out there creating art, trying to find ways to survive, because there was not going to be any silver bullet to survive. Nobody was going to write us a $10 million check and say, hey, ride out this pandemic. So we found sources of revenue that would allow us to extend our runway, just keep paying people, keep people on staff, keep creating things. And it just kept us going. With partnership with the Wilbury, we last August, we did the Decameron Providence, which was 14 nights of theater, live in person outdoors, that we set up 10 different stages outside, so the audience members could take their chairs and go from stage to stage to stage in their own pods. We were written up in the New York Times for being one of three or four arts organizations across America that was actually producing live art at that point. We followed it up with several other productions. We took some of that money, we created an outdoor theater too. So out of shipping containers, we created a movie theater and a stage. So we were able to do theater outside during the pandemic, again, drive-in style, and sometimes just outdoor, drive-in style during the colder winter months, and then just outdoors when people could bring blankets and chairs to just sit there and experience art. So we just tried to, like I said, extend our runway, bring in money, continue being relevant, creating relevant art for the community, all proudly saying in a safe way. We had no transmissions of COVID amongst staff, audience members, performers, throughout over 250 live events, in-person events that we've done since the pandemic started. So we never shut down. We continue to, plug away, try to be resilient and adaptable to the conditions.
That's incredible. Yeah. I was saying, looking at some of the program that Waterfire was doing this year, And I think I said this to you and to some other people who work at WaterFire, like I can't imagine any other organization but WaterFire doing some of the things that WaterFire has done, sort of like the post office. You know, like we have to do this, whether it's raining or sleeting or whatever, like we used to do water fires in the rain and whatever. And, you know, and so that spirit sort of came through over, I think, the last year of the pandemic and all the craziness and everything. Some of the programming that went on at the WaterFire Arts Center were these remarkable exhibitions that you all were doing, whether it was Howard Bent Trey or the Rome show or the current Mary Beth Meehan show that you all have up. I mean, remarkable, remarkable exhibitions of contemporary art. When you were, when you all were envisioning what that space was going to be like, when I worked for WaterFire all that time ago, it was a very raw space and you're using it to store your trucks in and everything. It hadn't really transformed yet. When you were going through that transformation process, did you envision that it would be an exhibition space like that and that you would do exhibitions of that sort of caliber there?
Yes. I think from the day we bought the building, before we bought the building, we were always inspired by the space. It was like stepping into a cathedral, even when it was, you know, in a derelict, abandoned condition. It's a very inspiring space. So we always kind of felt it had opportunity, had opportunity ahead of it if we could realize that opportunity. And pandemic kind of accelerated some of that. But having said that, like we've had some major exhibitions here. Rosa Parks House, Ryan Mendoza, Rosa Parks House project was in 2018, I believe, was an extraordinary exhibition. Very interesting. A house that Rosa Parks had fled from Alabama and stayed, it was her brother's house, had stayed in Detroit. An artist, an American artist who was living in Berlin, brought it over there. And got a lot of media in the US about this shouldn't happen. So as a result of a foundation and other stuff, it came back here and Brown was going to use it for an exhibition and then bailed. And we actually stepped up and hosted it. And that was really our first, I believe, first major exhibition in the space. And it was a full-blown house that was arrived in shipping containers and then carpenters put together a house. That's how give your any of your listeners, viewers, a perspective of how big this space is. We were able to put a two-story house inside of it. And then we had last, well, I say last year, we lost the year, didn't we? 2019, we had a British artist, Luke Jerram's Museum of the Moon, which was a 23-foot diameter sculpture of the moon. And we had 10,000 people come see that sculpture in the course of 3 weeks, which was pretty extraordinary. That was all in conjunction with the 50th anniversary of man landing on the moon. And we did a water fire downtown in conjunction with that. So we used a space like that, like we episodic, more episodic, because we were renting it a lot more frequently. But the pandemic has given us permission to kind of, and forced us actually to kind of think about other uses and how we could put the space to more use. So at the beginning of this year, we staged several sculpture events because we knew the pandemic was not going to allow us to host big events. So those events, Howard Bent Trey was the first, and then Robert Rome the second, were sculpture events that took floor space up. The current exhibition of Mary Beth Meehan, we planned to be more flexible in case somebody wanted to rent the space. We would be able to, most of the art is on the walls. We have some banners that hang down. Those could be rolled up if somebody wanted to rent the space. The pandemic hasn't really, the demand for the space hasn't recovered yet quite that way. So we've done some events here, but we haven't had to displace any of the artwork in any way. But so the pandemic, and especially in 2021, has given us this, you know, amazing opportunity to develop the art center as a true art center. And we're excited about that.
Do you see, like, as demand comes back in the next year or so, do you anticipate being able to continue to host shows like that? Or are you going to sort of rethink the exhibition component based on how demand is for the space for events and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think we're, you know, we're adaptable and we knew from the beginning we had to kind of figure that out if we're going to use it for exhibition space. And it has been popular. Now this might create a development opportunity, a fundraising opportunity that could help us develop the art center as a resource. I think the future is still somewhat uncertain, but we are planning 1 to 2 major exhibitions a year like we currently have, which is what we did previously, because it is a revenue stream we really need when we rent the space out. It's, you know, it's upwards of $250,000 a year of revenue to an organization, which, you know, you got to keep in mind, we're doing this major public event downtown, the 50 to 60,000 people, 100, a million people a year, and it's admission free. Like, you can come experience this and you're not paying anything to have this transformative experience. So we have to find other revenue streams to support those initiatives. And the Art Center was helpful, you know, one of the helpful things. One of the helpful things about that. So one thing we did, though, commit is that we have an area called the Visitor Center. It's about 3,000 square feet. And we fully committed to always show art in there now, since we've really trying to just seed this idea that we are a true art center. So that space will not be rented for other events, especially on, you know, it could be used for when we're not open for other activities, but it will always have art in it. And we're working on a schedule for that.
Oh, that's great. And even that space is quite large in terms of, as far as Rhode Island art galleries go, Rhode Island has a lot of large exhibition spaces. One of the other things that you've been doing recently is the Troupe Thursdays. Was that a partnership between you and Troupe Restaurant that you anticipated in advance of this year, or is that something that was a response to this year? And what has the feedback on that been like? Because it seems like that has been a much younger crowd and has engaged with sort of a different element of the community than other cultural organizations are getting to right now, I guess. So what are those like?
Yeah, so that was a bit inspired, I think, by, and this is, you know, nobody's reinventing the wheel here. It was, I think, a bit inspired by a trip my girlfriend and I took out to Massmocha earlier this year in February, where it was a Friday night and the museum was open. Only two people bought a ticket, and it was an audio experience. So you got what's her name, Khaki King, I think, or a guitarist. You got a, when you arrived there, you got a special SoundCloud playlist, and you had free access to the museum. It was a very small number of people in the museum, the height of the pandemic. And it was just like this cool experience at night. And it was kind of like, what should we do? Like, lots of museums have Thursday night, you know, later gallery hours for people that are in work and want to see a show. And we thought, well, what can we do with our space? So we decided to open up on Thursday nights and partner with Troupe, a local restaurant. What we try to do at Waterfire is always super hyper local. So they were a great partner to do this with. And in fact, even inside of that, they sell only Revival beer, which the brewery is just about 100 yards from here. And they sell only Hope and Anchor wine, which is a new Rhode Island winery. And we've had some Rhode Island food here. That was part of Troupe Top. So it's like trying to get a younger demographic to come out after work. We have a beautiful, we have a beautiful deck that we set it up. We have a DJ for it. We're trying to create this kind of fun, hip, you know, environment, trying to get younger people involved with what we're doing here. And then we've done it inside on days when the weather hasn't been suitable for outside. So it's all a work in progress. I think you'll still see us continue when we have an exhibition be open on Thursday nights. We're trying to evaluate whether it makes sense to continue with Troupe Top Thursdays. But it's all a bit of an experiment, and it's been fun.
That's great. And speaking of the sort of young component and young people, a big part of Waterfire's outreach, I mean, it always felt like to me, as somebody who experienced it, was the internship program that Waterfire was so active in reaching out. I mean, when I was an intern with Waterfire, I don't know how many interns, I think there were several dozen or something. I mean, I remember meeting a lot of interns when I worked there, and it was sort of like whatever your interest was, you could have an internship in that at Waterfire, whether it was development or on the creative side or on the production side or something. Can you talk about that? And over the years, you know, how many students have been impacted by that and what that's like having that at Waterfire?
Yeah, we have a very robust internship program. We're super proud of like seeing people like you, like we're super proud of what you've accomplished and all the things you're doing with your business and with your work at the Providence Art Club. So it's pretty robust. Go to our website. There's detailed job descriptions that you can kind of, if you have an interest level in almost anything, you can probably find an opportunity. Whether it's the business of art, whether it's being creative, whether it's graphic design, whether it's managing volunteers. I mean, there's a variety of opportunities for young people to kind of get involved. Most of them are college students, sometimes high school students, sometimes even graduates that just want some experience with us. When you're part of the internship program, you're really just part of the staff and team. You're really, we give you responsibility. This is not a an internship program where you're like, you know, we've had Johnson & Wales students sometimes come to us for some of the hospitality stuff, and some of their other internships were like folding napkins and stuff. They kind of, like, this is not that. This is like, you're really part of the team. You get real responsibility for the project as it goes forward. So you're learning, you're learning very valuable professional and life skills while you're with us. And I think in 2019, the summer of 2019, we had 27 interns outnumbered staff that summer. So that was probably our biggest number of interns from all over the country. A lot of times there'll be locals who come home for the summer from school, but sometimes we've had many who came here, had to find housing, and were successful with that. Many colleges, it is an unpaid internship program at this point. We're trying to work on that, but we've had many interns. I think you know one of them that we've had in the last year that actually have gotten sponsorship or scholarships or grants to cover the cost of their internships. So you know, some schools actually pay their interns, which is helpful for us as a nonprofit.
That's amazing. Yeah, that's great to know. Let's see, what other questions do I have here? WaterFire is such a multifaceted sort of event and something that's sort of hard to describe. And like I was saying, brings people of all these different kind of backgrounds to it. You know, Barnaby Evans, who created WaterFire, is very much an artist and very much sort of a philosophical person, I think. And you, it seems, come to WaterFire with skills that are more sort of business focused. And I think to an external viewer seem sort of more practical, quote unquote, than like what an artist does. You, as someone coming to it with a, you know, an education background in business and with previous experiences in business and in leadership and in all these things, do you feel like you are bringing skills that are very different from what sort of people who come from the art side of things bring? And how do those skills sort of jive with visual art and stuff like that?
Yeah, I think so. I attribute a lot of my like leadership and management skills that I developed over the years, going back to my high school days, where I actually sailed on a ship for 4 years of high school. And when you grow up as a mariner and a sailor, you kind of learn about responsibility and the delegation of responsibility, and the idea that you have to be adaptable, because, you know, when you sail in some place, it's not like driving a car or with a map and Waze or a map quest or whatever, dating myself. But it's like you have to figure out get from point A to point B, and the weather can change and all kinds of things can happen. And in the business world, those things happen. So I think like an arts organization needs to be kind of flexible and nimble. And you obviously got to be creative. So you have to kind of but you also have to, you know, it's business. And you have to survive at the end of the day, right? You have to like bring in more money than you pay out, or you're going to be doing it for a pretty short period of time. So, you know, I think we have a healthy balance here. I think we've been able to accomplish a lot of things in the 10 years I've been here and grow, as an organization, as a result of like, leveraging our strengths. Like I said, Barnaby has a good business mind, a strong business mind too. And, you know, I've certainly over the last year have probably been, you know, instrumental in a lot of these arts initiatives that we've done. So, but at the end of the day, like, you know, my job is really on the business side. His job is really the visionary of the organization, the creator and founder and the artistic leader. And I would never hold myself up to be able to think like he does and create the things that he does. So it's, you know, I think it's a healthy balance. It's probably easier to find somebody like me than it is to find somebody like him, to be honest. Like, so there are people out there with business skills and leadership skills that can slot in probably a lot of nonprofit. But, you know, what he's created is extremely, you know, unique. The power of WaterFire continues to draw people year after year after year. I mean, when he started it, he didn't think it was going to ever do that. But he's created something very magical that is a huge, huge popular event. And like I said, huge, huge for the economy, but we don't do it for that. All the economic numbers I rattled off to you earlier, it's really about like making people proud, creating a pride of place and making people feel good about the place that they're in, and transforming place. And because we feel, unless you feel good about where you live or where you work or where you're visiting, you won't, you know, if you live there, if you don't feel good about it, you know, you either move to find someplace better or you become complacent and become part of the problem. Same thing with working there. And then you're not going to come visit a place that isn't inspiring. So, you know, our role is to inspire people, whether you live here or you're visiting here or working here. And that's what gets us all going. So the economic is the economic impact we create is a great lever to be able to do the things we do and making art that inspires people.
Yeah, that's amazing. On the also sort of on the business side of it, what is the, as a nonprofit, what is the makeup of WaterFire's board like right now? Like what sort of different individuals are steering the organization and what kind of skills are those people contributing? And I guess sort of as an extra question, how would you encourage sort of business-minded people to support arts organizations by board service or by volunteering or anything like that?
If you believe in something in your community, whether it's a soup kitchen or it's an arts organization or it's an animal welfare business, you know, welfare organization, you should get involved. I mean, this is what makes the wholeness of community really. And organizations need skill sets. They need the experiences. They need the professional talents of a diverse group of people, whether they bring financial acumen or media and marketing or whatever. So if you have any, you know, if you're good at what you do and you have any skills, and you're a young person especially, if you're a person of color, I think there's tremendous opportunities for you right now. If you want to make a difference, they're out there like crazy. The opportunities, there's no excuse for any young person, period, but any person, you know, any person can absolutely get involved. And, you know, it can be challenging, you know. It's a group of volunteers. You know, I think you should be very committed to what you're doing. It's not like, I'd like to do this if I can do it. It's like you need to commit to it in a way because the organization is going to rely on you for what you say you're going to do, the way you're going to bring to the organization. So it's not like, oh, I can't make this. You know, you got to really build it into your schedule that my board meetings are this and that's my priority. I also think, you know, if you're going to get involved, you shouldn't overextend yourself. Pick one thing that you kind of start out with, one thing, and really commit to that instead of getting involved with too many things. Because you can make a real difference in not only in that organization, but in your community. But it's hard. It is hard work. You know, it can be time consuming and hard work.
Yeah, you have to really be committed to it. The other question I was going to ask is, so as an organization that is so publicly focused and is a public art piece and all of these different components to it, you rely to some extent, I mean, you raise a lot of your own funds, but then you do rely on some public funding and things like that. And one of the news stories this summer was the issue of WaterFire not getting the funding it needed. Can you talk about navigating that and about maybe that specific experience, if you can talk about it, and how the funding finally did come together, because now you do have a season schedule. Can you talk about that at all?
Sure. So, you know, what we're doing, so this will come back to the economic numbers. Like, and it was pure and simple. Through this pandemic, we knew we needed help through federal funding sources. And it was CARES Act in 2020, and in 2021, it was American Rescue Plan funding. So that's, we made this pitch. We just knew that sponsorship market continues to be dormant. So, you know, some stuff, drips and drabs are coming in, but if we were going to survive, and everybody wanted to survive because the hospitality industry has been hammered by the pandemic. Hotels actually closed. Occupancy rates are really continue to be quite low. And we were hit up. We actually almost did WaterFire back in December because we get so much pressure from the hospitality industry to actually put something on to draw people into these hotels. And then really in nearly the 11th hour, in the planning stages, the people in the sector who we were working with kind of saw that the numbers were rising again and pulled the plug. And we felt very good about that because we were actually more reluctant, I think, than they were. lost my train of thought on what we were going with that.
About the public funding piece of
The public funding. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. So through the whole pandemic, you know, we've been like, this is the impacts we create. If you see value in these impacts, then we need your help right now. If there was ever a time to need help, and these programs were designed to help. So like, there's a bit of this like teach a man to fish thing, right? It's like, we have tremendous, we create tremendous multiplier effects at WaterFire through that economic impact. So an investment in WaterFire multiplies out through the economy, through the community, through more jobs, through more activity, through more media. So through that process, we may continue to make this consistent pitch that like we need these funding sources. It was easier in 2020 because CARES Act funding had to be spent by December 31st, 2020, the way that act was written. American Rescue Plan funding is very much more difficult because that doesn't have to be spent till 2024. So the urgency all of a sudden of getting that money out in the hands of people is non-existent. It's now thought of as a strategic tool to recover from the pandemic. So we needed it today to be able to survive and continue. So our you know, challenge was convincing people that we needed it as of today. And we worked, we've continued through this whole pandemic, where we worked really closely and successfully with Karmas RI, which is the Economic Development Office of the State of Rhode Island. And with the mayor's office, we put together a plan of how we could put WaterFire on this fall if funding exists and the health conditions, allowed us to do that. So somewhere along the line, somebody, you know, the city hall, city council, there's a lot of worthy initiatives, right? There's a pandemic. There's lots of people that need support. And it was determined, even though we had this governor's support, Commerce's support, and the mayor's support, city council kind of had a little hiccup there. And initially, they did not recommend that we get funded. That comes back to that argument. If you think it's valuable, you need to invest in it. If you don't think it's valuable, then we never talked about anything in negative about this. This is a decision that they made. The public outcry from that decision was pretty extreme when it hit the media. And, and we continued to talk through the whole process with them, and they were great to work with, and they kind of came around. Ultimately, there was some faction on city council that wanted it to be from the beginning, and then everybody after the weekend when it came into the media that city council had voted no, the next week city council saw the light, and they heard their voters, and they reversed their position. So one of the arguments we made, I think demonstrates itself pretty well too, is that not only do we have this economic impact I just identified, but we also have this tremendous media value for the city of Providence and state of Rhode Island. And so as soon as it was the city council voted on the funding and matched what the state was able to provide us, as soon as that happened, major national media responded. Travel and Leisure that week said one of the top 10 places to travel to in October was Providence, Rhode Island. In the world, Providence, Rhode Island. In the first paragraph, it said, WaterFire is returning. Yeah. We were 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, Good Morning America approached us, and they did a thing about Rhode Island's recovery and did a great piece about WaterFire and all of Rhode Island's tourist attractions, but really profiled and highlighted WaterFire. On that same week, Condé Nast Traveler also wrote an article about Providence being the hippest city in New England and featured WaterFire, WaterFire Art Center, and actually True Pop Thursday, which we're really proud about. So that was a demonstration of the value of media, because these are influencing travelers, and those are the people who fill hotels and eat in our restaurants and do all the things you need to have a vibrant hospitality industry. So once we were able to announce that, yes, we had enough money to put on a few WaterFires this fall, the national media, you know, responded, and that's another thing that we bring to. So this stuff all kind of takes care of itself if you think you're doing good work. the right thing. You know, it takes care of itself. And so we had a little hiccup there, but we really appreciate city council support and, you know, the mayor's consistent support and the governor's support and Commerce RI support. So without it,
success story. Yeah, it was frightening for a minute. So now once you have your funding for the season, now you're ready to go. What was it like planning the forthcoming water fires that you have sort of planned? And what can people expect this season going sort of into the late summer and fall from experiencing water fire?
Yeah, so we had a press event a couple of weeks ago, and we announced that we have plans to do 9 lightings starting hopefully on Labor Day weekend, September 4th, Saturday. Excuse me. Of those 9 lightings, there'll be 4 fulls, which is a half a mile through the city, and then 5 partials, which is a smaller area where we don't have to close streets. They might be on weekday nights, drive traffic to hotels on weekday nights. So that's what we announced. Those would go all the way through a holiday water fire in the first week of December. We've said that they'll be a little different than they've been in the past few years, almost a return to what they were in the beginning with less of the commercial activity on the shore side, fewer vendors, fewer food vendors, and we're still working on what that looks like exactly. And one thing I have to just like reiterate is we're not out of COVID. So, water fire doesn't happen with a flick of a light switch. It like takes months of planning and execution before we can actually do the first one. If we were ever going to do it in 2021, we needed to start that planning. And we had a kind of in June, July, we had this drop dead date of when we could start because it's going to take us 2 to 3 months to get ready. So we're in the process of getting ready. We're also monitoring the Delta variant and other impacts that the pandemic, coronavirus, COVID has had or is having currently. So we will remain vigilant and we'll remain committed to only producing safe events. So what we announced at the press conference is our plan. That plan is subject to change depending on. We have now the funding to do stuff. It's just, are the health conditions going to allow us to do it?
That makes sense. Let's see. What's another question that I have?
I'll just come back to that one, actually. Just finish up on that question.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the last time we did water fire was November 2019, a very popular Salute to Veterans fire in the first week of November. After that fire, we had to pull everything out of the river, which typically some stuff will stay in the river in a normal year. But that year, the river was dredged. So our recovery this year has been even more effort, more resource intensive, because we have to reinstall from scratch. And we had to replace things that were destroyed through that process. You know, you don't destroy an audio cable when it's able to lay in the riverbed for a period of years. It might get caught or whatever. You could patch it, whatever. But when a whole river gets dredged, lots of things get lost and lots of things get damaged. So we're currently right now in the exercise of reinstalling everything throughout the river, laying new cable and doing all that. And it's a lot more work than we would typically have had there not been a major dredging project of that river.
And does that add like another month to the preparation, or how much is there sort of a timeline for how much that adds? Was it this week that you were putting the like braziers back in? I saw there was a crane out and stuff. So that adds significant time then for you all.
It does. So the anchor systems had to be taken out of the river and they're stored in another part of the river that wasn't dredged. And now our staff has brought them in. And then for several weekends, late yesterday, in fact, we had a huge team of volunteers with our staff reinstalling the braziers on the anchor systems throughout the installation. So, you know, it takes time. They can do like 25 systems a day, and there's nearly 100 of them when you have that big of volunteer. So when you have that big volunteer call days like we had on Sunday and we had one several Saturdays ago, we're able to do a number of them. When we just have staff, it's a much slower process. And we had this great Stanley Tree Company is a local tree company that donated their crane, and they've been a partner for us. Really great community-minded organization that has helped us reinstall for the last few years when we had to put stuff back in. And when we have their support, it expedites things. It just, it makes it so much easier to have a big crane to be able to do this.
Absolutely. It seems like, so WaterFire, like from all the stories that you're sharing, you know, WaterFire has this incredible sort of network of partners and friends and all these people. Not every arts organization is as lucky as WaterFire to have that sort of network. So what advice would you give to people who are working within sort of smaller arts organizations on how to build that kind of resiliency and how to build that sort of network that WaterFire enjoys?
Yeah, well, whatever you do well, just find partners that are interested in what you're doing. That's where we were talking to earlier about board service. You can, you know, I think that helps sometimes. But WaterFire is unique. It's 25 plus years. This year we're celebrating the 25th season of WaterFire. So WaterFire is unique in that it reaches and it touches so many different parts of the community, I think. But every organization in the community has opportunities to engage their local businesses, their other community leaders, their other nonprofits. Like one thing I feel really lucky about here in Rhode Island, particularly in Providence, is a collegial atmosphere that that nonprofit execs have. I'm in a peer leadership group with our colleagues over at Steelyard and AS220, two other like rocking arts organizations in town here, in a peer group with Farm Fresh and Southside Community Land Trust. Is this really like, let's get together and work on things together and solve problems together, support each other. WaterFire is very much like all of WaterFire is this collaborative arts experience. We can't, if it was just WaterFire itself, it wouldn't be as powerful as when we have all these different capoeira groups or you know, we do themes for different heritages. So Chinese Culture Night, or whatever it is, we really kind of reach out and engage the community in WaterFire and give them a platform for all, you know, 50, 60,000 people to present their work. There are, whether it's Festival Ballet, who is a regular performer with us. I mean, we're constantly collaborating with other people. So just having an open, additive, abundance mindset and not a scarcity mindset as a nonprofit leader, I think is, you know, really important.
That's great. That's great. For people who would like to sort of support WaterFire in whatever way they can, what are the best ways for people to support WaterFire right now? Whether it's, are there sort of certain services that you need, or are you more interested in people supporting through volunteerism or donations, or what are the best ways or the things that you need most at WaterFire?
We want you to engage in every and every which way, any and every which way that you want to engage with. So if you have, you know, you want to sponsor, we have opportunities there. We create really, really unique, impactful marketing engagements for corporations to touch audiences, whether it's downtown or even here at the WaterFire Art Center. We always need volunteers. So that could be actually corporate as well. We do work with a lot of large corporations that do team building exercises through volunteerism with us. Down to the individual. If you're just new to the community and you want to meet some great people, we have volunteers who have been here way before I've been, like from the very beginning. We have, and when I say some, we have many that are just like, they plan their life. They're every WaterFire. This is like part of their life, part of their family. They work other jobs. They do other things, a diversity of different kind of professions. But what brings them together is this love and passion for creating this art that really inspires people. So volunteer. And then, you know, we obviously, like every nonprofit, need financial support. So if anybody has, you know, any interest in supporting us, we actually last year started a thing called the WaterFire Relief Fund. In 2020, with $1 million goal. We're a little more than halfway there, I think, to help us kind of continue to keep people employed, to keep creating art. We are actually transitioning that, rebranding that to call it the WaterFire Future Fund, to have a more positive outlook instead of like this doom and gloom sound of relief fund. So they can support us. You click on our website, it's really easy to find. It's right there, but it's also waterfire.org/donate, I think, or support. We'll get you to our page for, you know, making and any gift size, small, large, is much appreciated. And then, you know, also come and experience what we do here in the WaterFire Art Center. Just come to WaterFire, because when you come to WaterFire, you actually are contributing to WaterFire. WaterFire is only, the WaterFire event downtown is only powerful because of the people who are, they're actually part of the artwork. You're not really an audience member. You're you're part of the experience when you come experience Wildfire.
That's great. Thank you. This has been such a great conversation. I really appreciate talking to you. There's so many different things we could talk about when it comes to Wildfire. My last question for you, Peter, is what are you most looking forward to? I mean, assuming things continue to go in the right direction, hopefully, what are you most looking forward to in the coming year or so at Wildfire?
Yeah, we're all looking forward to getting back down on the river and creating what we do. So, you know, getting people to come out to experience Wildfire, obviously it's got to be safe. So we're not going to do anything that's silly. We're not going to create any kind of super spreader event or anything like that. We've been committed to that from the beginning. But, you know, longer term, it's like coming out of this pandemic, you got to look at the silver lining of every cloud, right? And like, it's given us this opportunity to develop the Wildfire Art Center as this really powerful, rich resource for the community here, whether it's the Valley Olneyville neighborhood. It's been a catalyst for change in this neighborhood, but throughout the state, and I'd say throughout the region, there's no other space to see art like this space. And it allows us to show some, you know, monumental art. And it's a very different space. So you might have been to Mass MoCA out in Western Mass, or, you know, there's some places in New York City that have big spaces, Pioneer Works, but you know, there's not a lot of places in New England that have this what we have here. So we're looking forward to coming out of the pandemic stronger. We've hired staff to focus on that, and just we're looking to survive this pandemic and then have diversified our mission and being a stronger organization, hopefully, as a result of that.
That's great. Well, thanks again for spending time with me, Peter. It was really nice talking to you. I appreciate it.
It's so great talking to you, Michael, and keep up the good work.
Thanks. Have a good one, Peter.
All right. Goodbye.
So I'd like to thank Peter again for a great conversation. It was really fun talking to Peter, learning more about his perspectives on what the pandemic has meant to organizations like Wildfire, what his role is all about, and what's going on at Wildfire Providence. You can learn more about what Wildfire is up to at their website, www.wildfire.org, and you can also follow Peter on Instagram, Twitter, and on Clubhouse at Peter Mello, PeterMello. So I thank you for listening to another one of my conversations, and I'm looking forward to hosting more of these podcasts with different leaders in the visual arts, and I hope you'll subscribe so that you don't miss my upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to Fine Art Insights with Michael Rose.